Part 4. The Wedding. 1. Morning light filled my window. I squinted and turned away from the sun, pulling the blankets over my shoulders. A daddy long legs crouched on my pillow, just inches from my face, and I brushed it away. Another spider watched me from my bedpost, but I left that one alone. I would deal with it later. I just wanted to sleep. But then I remembered. I sat up and swung my legs out of bed, and a sudden stabbing pain fired through the base of my skull. Holy Mother of God. My brain felt skewered. I closed my eyes and gritted my teeth and tried to gather my bearings. I was back in my cottage, back in the kiddie room with its storybook corner and brightly colored fish wallpaper. Back in the bottom bunk, though I had no recollection of coming here. The last thing I remembered was wrestling a naked, sweaty Errol Gardner to the floor. I remembered mashing the flat front of my palm into his face. A dream, I told myself. A horrible, anxiety-fueled nightmare. Except my knuckles were split, my lower back was sore, and I was dressed in all my same clothes from the night before. I reached for my scalp and felt a tender, throbbing lump. My hair was caked with dried blood, and before I even understood what was happening, I was throwing up. I made it to the bathroom, but not the toilet, and vomited all over the sink. I gripped the towel rack to steady myself and tried to collect my thoughts.
Love is patient. Love is kind.
He's the Prince of fucking Darkness.
There they go, bending reality again. Dawn Taggart is the least of your worries. Your daughter is getting exactly what she wants.
The hurt inside my head was excruciating. It felt like a piece of my brain had been cut out, and now the raw, tender wound was exposed. I switched on the light and cleared the spiders off the mirror so I could see my reflection. My shirt was streaked with dirt and blood. Two of its buttons were missing. I looked like an extra in a zombie movie, one of these businessmen commuting to the office who gets infected by the virus. I turned on the tap, splashed cold water on my face, and rinsed out my mouth. I had a couple of toiletries on the counter, a toothbrush, deodorant, a bottle of cologne, but I did not bother to collect them. I only cared about two things, getting Maggie and getting far away from Osprey Cove. The display on my Timex said 11:53, but of course this was still Gardner Standard Time. I fumbled with the little buttons and turned back the clock to 11:38, Eastern Standard Time. No more bullshit. Then I went into the closet to grab my suitcase. As soon as the motion light flickered on, dozens more spiders scattered across the walls, panicked by my sudden arrival. I just grabbed my bag and closed the door, because they didn't matter anymore. In another 5 minutes, I would be gone. I found my cell phone in my pocket and discovered the battery was down to its last 8%, and there was one new notification, a voicemail, from Vicky, left at 10:52 a.m. I pressed play and listened.
I didn't hear back from you last night, so I hope everything's okay. I wanted to let you know I did reach out to my son, Todd, the one at the newspaper. Now, don't worry, Frank. I didn't say anything. I just asked if he'd heard anything squirrely about the Gardners, because a lot of times these writers have hints of a story, but not enough sources to put the whole thing into print. And I get the feeling this might be one of those situations, because Todd got pretty quiet and said he couldn't tell me anything. Which is his way of saying there is something. And you should be careful, so give me a call when you get this. I'll explain it better over the phone.
But I didn't need her to explain it any better. I didn't need advice from Vicky or anyone else. I put my suitcase on the bottom bunk and unzipped the lid, just as Tammy appeared at my bedroom door. She gave a quick, perfunctory knock before opening it.
Listen, Frankie. I just wanted to check on you, make sure you're... Oh my goodness! Look at your face and your shirt.
Pack your stuff. We're leaving. She smiled uneasily, like she was expecting me to follow my announcement with a punchline.
What are you talking about? What's going on?
I don't know, Tammy. I have no idea what's happening. But I know this wedding's a joke. Maggie's made a terrible mistake, and we need to get her out of here.
Frankie, Frankie, calm down.
Tammy moved closer and rested a gentle hand on my arm.
Maggie is fine, okay? I just saw her. We just had breakfast together. Me and Maggie and Abigail. We had strawberry pancakes, and Maggie is 100% all right. Today is her wedding day, remember? She's marrying Aiden Gardner.
I know what day it is. Why are you talking to me like I'm a toddler?
Because you sound confused. I was here last night when they brought you home. Maggie said you had too much to drink. She said you fell and hurt your head.
And you believed her?
Of course.
You think I got drunk and blacked out at my own daughter's rehearsal dinner? Does that sound like anything I've ever done?
Well, no, Frankie, but if I'm being honest, you haven't been yourself these past few days. I think you're under an enormous amount of stress. What do you think happened last night?
I didn't want to tell her. A part of me hoped that if I kept my discoveries to myself, they wouldn't be true. But I knew I wouldn't get far without my sister's help. I sat down on the lower bunk and invited her to sit beside me, because I knew the story would take a while. Last night, during dinner, I went inside Osprey Lodge, and I met Catherine Gardner. She's not sick, Tammy. She doesn't have migraines. She's had some kind of mental breakdown. She's completely intoxicated around the clock, and that's why she hasn't joined us. And she's the one who killed Dawn Taggart. Tammy leaned away from me, like she suddenly feared I was contagious.
Okay, stop.
She crushed her skull with a car battery, and Aiden was here when it happened. He saw the whole thing.
Stop, stop, stop. I don't need to know.
Tammy, you're not hearing me clearly. I am telling you that Catherine Gardner murdered a pregnant woman, right here in the camp, and Aiden helped her cover it up.
I am hearing you clearly, and I'm telling you, it's not our dirty laundry. Every family has secrets. Let's mind our own business.
I stared at my sister in disbelief. This was a woman who had devoted her entire life to helping others. Dozens of foster children and countless senior citizens. She'd always been quick to rail against injustice, but now I felt like I was speaking to a different person. And I still hadn't told her the worst part. After I talked to Catherine, I went to Maggie's cottage, way off deep in the woods, and I found her, in bed with Errol Gardner. I searched my sister's face, looking for any kind of reaction, but her expression didn't change. Do you understand what I just told you? She was having sex with her future father-in-law the night before her wedding. I threw him on the floor and started hitting him. Then Hujo clubbed me over the head, and that's the last thing I remember. For a long moment, my sister didn't say anything. I assumed she was overwhelmed by the story and struggling to make sense of it. But when she finally spoke, she surprised me.
I hear that you're upset.
I blinked. You hear that I'm upset?
I believe everything you're saying is true, and I understand why it bothers you. It bothers me, too. I wish Maggie had made different choices, but this is Maggie we're talking about. You can't say you're surprised.
Yes, I can. I am.
Frankie, come on. I helped you bring her up, and I love that girl as much as you do. But be honest with yourself. She has a history.
What kind of history?
Of manipulating people, using them to get what she wants, All that business with her sorority sisters and doctor's cell phone. Think about the whole reason Maggie stopped talking to you.
She stopped talking to me because I let her down. She asked for my help, and I turned my back on her.
No, Frankie, that is not what happened. She's manipulated you into seeing things that way. Because, again, she is very good at manipulating people. Especially you. As I recall, you were just trying to do the right thing.
I couldn't process what she was saying. Things were moving too quickly, and I just wanted everything to stop. We need to help her.
She doesn't need help. This isn't Taken, and you're not Liam Neeson. You don't need to rescue Maggie. She knows exactly what she's doing. I don't understand the choice she's made, but it is clearly her choice. She wants this. I think we'll be a lot happier if we just accept it.
Dawn Taggart was murdered. And then Gwendolyn found out, and she was murdered too. Hu-Ho drugged her, and drowned her, and dumped her body like it was garbage.
But Maggie didn't hurt either one of them. And you know the gardeners are going to get away with it. These kinds of people always get away with it. They hire their lawyers and work the system.
So you're just going to pretend nothing happened? You think you can actually do that?
Frankie, I know I can. Because I'm tired, okay?
She could tell I was bewildered, so she tried to frame her answer differently.
We have very different circumstances, little brother. In 3 more years, you're going to retire with a pension and health care and the freedom to do anything you want. But me? There's no pension for me. If this wedding falls apart, if Errol takes back his 1,000 shares, I've got 40 grand in an IRA, plus whatever I shake out of Social Security. At that rate, I will never stop working. I'll be lubing catheters and treating bed sores until I'm 90 years old, and I don't want that life for myself anymore.
She gestured out the window to the rest of the camp.
Especially after seeing all this. Everything's so beautiful here.
I would take care of you, Tammy. I'm not going to let you end up in the poorhouse.
I don't want to leech off you. I don't want to ask for a handout every time my car needs new tires. I want to keep my 1,000 shares and have a nice, quiet retirement.
I felt another wave of pain coming on and gritted my teeth and squeezed the edge of the mattress, bracing myself for the worst. My big sister had always looked after me, always supported me, always stood by my side. But now she was a capacity shareholder, and I didn't recognize her anymore. She swiveled her fanny pack around her waist and unzipped the tiny pocket and removed a small bottle of Advil. She shook out 2 of the little brown tablets and gently placed them in my hand.
Tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna find Maggie and have her come over so you can talk. But before she gets here, you need to shower. You look awful, and you smell absolutely foul. Go clean yourself up. And while you're in there, I want you to remember why you and Maggie stopped speaking. Be honest with yourself, because this whole situation feels very familiar, Frankie. It feels very 3 years ago, and I don't want to see you make the same mistakes. You can trust that Maggie is ready to make adult choices with adult consequences, and you can have a real relationship with her. Or you can keep fighting her and undermining her decisions and destroy any chance of a future together. And as someone who cares about you, I am going to suggest you choose the former.
She patted my knee and then looked at her watch and discovered it was almost noon.
And you better get going. because you've only got 3 hours.
2. I took a long, hot shower and washed the blood from my hair as I reflected on my sister's advice. I tried to understand how I'd screwed up so badly, how I'd raised someone capable of making such disastrous choices. I didn't like dwelling on the recent past, but Tammy seemed to think I could learn a lesson or two from it, and maybe she was right. After Maggie finished college, I hoped she would move back home and take a job in Allentown or Reading. But she insisted that all the best career opportunities were in Boston. She needed a place to live, so I co-signed the lease on the basement studio apartment, and I agreed to pay her rent for the first year until she got on her feet. I knew it was only a matter of time until someone recognized her value and paid her a real salary. In the meantime, she worked 30 hours a week at Dr. Cellphone, one of these rinky-dink places that repairs the cracked glass screens of electronic devices. I only visited the store once, and my first impressions were not positive. It was a cluttered and stale room with bad artificial lighting. The carpet was worn, the windows were smudgy. In many ways, you could say the business was a reflection of its owner. Oliver Dingham was 46 years old, with pale, blotchy skin and a bad comb-over. Most days he dressed in nylon tracksuits, though it was hard to imagine him running on a track or any other surface. He'd inherited the business from his father, and he showed zero interest in growing it. Outside work, he was a self-described AFOL, an adult fan of Lego. And he'd filled his two-bedroom condo with intricate 3,000-brick recreations of Hogwarts Castle and the Millennium Falcon. And if I sound like I'm being overly critical of the man, it's only because he was clearly infatuated with his new 21-year-old employee.
"Not true," Maggie insisted after I confronted her with my fears. I told her she was blind to the basic calculus of the situation. Oliver was a balding, middle-aged incel who hadn't been on a date in years. Maggie was a bright and beautiful young woman, and together they spent 30 hours a week in a tiny room that saw little foot traffic. They might as well have been marooned on a deserted island. I pleaded with her to quit and find another job, at a restaurant or a bowling alley or any place she'd be around other young people. "You shouldn't be cooped up all week with that guy. You're wasting the best years of your life." But my concerns fell on deaf ears. Maggie claimed that any job in technology would look good on her resume, and she pointed out that Oliver was paying her $22 an hour, well above minimum wage, which to me was just another red flag. She insisted that Oliver never made a pass, but I knew it was only a matter of time. I started searching the help wanted ads on my daughter's behalf, looking for any kind of job that would get her away from Dr. Cellphone. I sent her all kinds of leads, but she never followed up on them. And I suppose this is when our relationship started to deteriorate. She called me meddling and hypercritical. I called her lazy and unfocused. Is it any wonder she stopped calling home? Or that our conversations became less and less frequent? When she announced she was staying in Massachusetts for Thanksgiving and Christmas to celebrate with friends, I was gutted. Then one Saturday morning in February, I woke to the sound of a car pulling into my driveway. It was early and still dark, just a little past 5:30. The vehicle pulled all the way up my driveway and around the back of my house. And then I heard a car door quietly open and close, as if the driver was taking pains not to disturb anyone. I hopped out of bed and went downstairs to my kitchen, arriving just in time to see my daughter unlocking the back door. "Surprise," she said. "I hope I didn't wake you."
She was dressed in ripped jeans, a dirty green sweatshirt, and beat-up Nikes, and she looked exhausted. I welcomed her with a hug, and I thought I smelled cigarette smoke in her hair, but I decided to let it slide. She explained that she'd been struck by a bout of homesickness, so she'd driven through the night to visit me. And now she was desperate for a shower and a nap. I made her scrambled eggs while she cleaned herself up and changed into fresh clothes. And while she slept, I did a little work on her car, topping off the fluids and checking the tire pressure and vacuuming the crumbs out of her floor mats. Later that morning, it started to snow, so we stayed around the house all day. Tammy came over with two of her foster kids, and the five of us made an enormous vat of chicken soup and loaves of fresh-baked bread. Once the yard was blanketed in white, Maggie took the kids outside to make snow angels and build an igloo, while Tammy and I watched through frosted windows with mugs of hot chocolate. After dinner, we put on some Billy Joel CDs and taught the foster kids how to play euchre and aw shucks. And it was pretty much a perfect day from start to finish. Sunday morning, Maggie seemed different. She'd emerged from her bedroom looking shaken. I'd heard her on the phone having a strained conversation, but I'd resisted the urge to eavesdrop. I asked her if everything was okay, and she said she was fine. We drove over to the Waffle House for brunch, and the waitresses welcomed her back like a homecoming queen. I ordered my usual farmer's omelet, and Maggie got the strawberry pancakes, but she barely touched her food. She seemed anxious to get back to Boston. I tried to make small talk, and I asked about her job search, but I didn't push too hard. She seemed frustrated by her lack of progress, and I didn't want to make her feel any worse. We were back at the house by 11 that morning, and she gathered her things to leave. I remember walking her out to her car, which had remained parked in my backyard all weekend.
"Oh, listen," she said, as she unlocked the driver's door. "Could I ask you for a favor?"
"Of course, kiddo. Shoot."
"If anyone asks what time I got here, could you say you're not sure?"
Maggie slipped inside her little Honda and rolled down the window to hear my answer, like she'd just asked me to water her plants or borrow $20. "You got here Saturday morning."
"Right. And I'm asking if you could be a little less specific. Like, say you went to bed Friday night and never heard me come in, because I have my own key, and when you woke up Saturday morning, I was asleep in my bed."
"But you weren't asleep in your bed. You were awake in my driveway." She replied with a long, exasperated sigh, as if I was missing the point.
"You don't have to lie. You just have to pretend you didn't see me pulling in."
"That is lying. That's not what happened."
"It's what almost happened. If you didn't wake up so fucking early, you would think it's the truth, because you would have found me in my bed, and I would have told you I was there all night."
My pulse started to quicken. This was bad. I knew it was bad. "Maggie, get out of the car, please. Let's go inside and talk about this." Instead, she started the engine.
"I have to leave."
"I'll help you, but you need to answer some questions."
"Since when? What happened to Mr. No Questions Asked?"
This was always my rule back in high school, when Maggie started going to parties and staying out late. I told her that if she ever needed a ride home or any other kind of assistance, she could call me at any hour, and I would rush to get her. No questions asked.
"That's who I need right now," she said. "I need Mr. No Questions Asked. Please don't overcomplicate this, okay?"
She was already backing out of the driveway as she made her final plea. She was going a little too fast and clipped my trash bin before rolling off the curb and veering out into the street. Then she shifted into drive and sped out of sight. I walked back inside the house and started to rehearse my story. I didn't understand what was happening, but I knew a call was coming, and I wanted to be ready. I'd gone to bed early Friday night, and I didn't hear Maggie come in. When I woke up Saturday morning, I found her asleep in her bed. That night, I had leftover chicken soup for dinner. It was usually better the second day, but not this time. After I finished washing the dishes, I emptied my kitchen trash and carried the bag out to my driveway. When I lifted the lid on the bin, I noticed there was another bag already inside. It was a 10-gallon bag, but mostly empty, and I knew I hadn't put it there. I pulled it out and carried it to the privacy of my backyard, and then patiently worked out the knot. Inside were Maggie's ripped jeans and dirty green sweatshirt, and her socks, sneakers, bra, and underwear, plus a pair of cheap yard gloves and a plain navy ball cap. I put it all back in the bag, then put the bag back in the bin, and then I dragged the bin out to the curb so it would get picked up the following morning. It was a long and mostly sleepless wait until sunrise when I heard the low groan of the garbage trucks turning onto my street. They carried away all the evidence, but none of my worries. The days passed, then weeks, and then a full month, and I almost allowed myself to relax. It seemed like Maggie was correct. Everything was fine. No one called me with any questions, and I'd been seeing problems where problems didn't exist. I sent a few casual texts to my daughter and asked how she was doing. Her replies were brief, but friendly. She told me that she'd stopped working for Dr. Cellphone and found a new job as a barista. Meanwhile, she was emailing lots of resumes and hoping to find a better gig. All positive signs for a brighter future. And then Maggie got the offer from Capacity. She called me to share the good news, and we celebrated for close to an hour. It was her first professional job in a brand new office in downtown Cambridge, with a modest entry-level salary plus performance bonuses, Blue Cross health insurance, and a slew of corporate benefits. Capacity employees had free access to the Museum of Fine Arts and the New England Aquarium. They received 10% off all purchases from Hertz, Avis, Southwest Airlines, and 100 other businesses. She read from a list that went on and on. And I remember feeling so proud of her. I knew it was hard to get your foot in the door when you didn't have any personal connections, and Maggie had risen to the challenge. The road to this point had been a little bumpy, but she'd finally made it. Now her future was wide open, and I sent her a large bouquet of flowers with a card. Congratulations, you did it. About 3 weeks later, I came home from work to find a white Chevy Impala parked in front of my house. At my arrival, the driver opened his door and waved to me. He was a black man, dressed in a shirt and tie, and there was something in his demeanor that reminded me of my father. Not so much his age, he was only a half generation older than me. But his overall attitude. He had the kind of leisurely gait that I see on a lot of older guys who choose to work well past their retirement age. The pensions are locked up, so all the pressure's off, but they're enjoying themselves too much to quit. Mr. Zatowski? He was walking up my driveway.
I'm Leonard Summers. I work with the State Fire Marshal of Massachusetts. Could I ask you a couple questions?
Was there a fire?
Yes, sir. Pretty big one. Margaret didn't mention it.
Is she all right?
He nodded and said my daughter was safe, and then he repeated his question. She didn't mention any fire?
I haven't spoken to her in a while. She just started a new job.
Right. I heard about that.
He reached into his pocket for a tiny notebook and opened it.
Something called Capacity, right? Spelled with two I's? Up until this moment, I'd hoped that Leonard Summers was mistaken, that he'd come to the wrong house for the wrong Margaret Zatowski. But evidently not. "That's correct," I told him. "C-I-T-I. Gosh, my mother would have hated that," he said with a smile. "She taught second grade in Roxbury, and she was a stickler for spelling, always railing against Fruit Loops and Kool-Aid for making her kids illiterate. And nowadays it's so much worse. Lyft, Chick-fil-A, capacity with two eyes. It's good she's not around to see it, you know." He spoke like we had all the time in the world, and I just smiled politely and endured the anecdote and wondered why this man had come to see me. My next-door neighbor opened her front door and stepped outside, making a pretense of reaching into her mailbox, but clearly just eavesdropping. Leonard Summers offered her a friendly wave and called out, "Good afternoon," and then suggested we speak indoors. We went into my kitchen, and I offered to make coffee. He said he never drank coffee after lunch because the caffeine kept him awake, but a glass of water would be nice. So I poured two glasses of water and joined him at the kitchen table. "I want to ask you about Margaret's previous job," he explained. "Last week, I arrested a man named Oliver Dingham. Have you ever met him?"
"Once."
"When was that?" "A couple months ago. I went to Boston to visit my daughter, and she showed me where she worked." "So you've been to the store? Dr. Cellphone?"
"Briefly, but yes, I've been there."
"Good, good, good. That saves me some time. About 2 months ago, on the night of February 7th, Oliver Dingham started a fire that destroyed the entire building." He removed a laptop from his satchel, then opened the screen to show me photos of the wreckage. The building had been reduced to a smoldering pile of rubble and twisted steel. "Now, I have been doing my job for a long time, and I have met some very bad arsonists. But Mr. Dingham is easily the worst. The poor fool made just about every mistake in the book. For example, most accidental fires can be traced back to a single point of origin, a space heater, say, or a dropped cigarette. But the fire at Dr. Cellphone had three separate and distinct points of origin, three giant red flags screaming, 'Not an accident.' Do you follow? And on top of that, we found traces of acetone all over the interior, which simply makes no sense. If it was a nail salon, sure, you'd expect to find acetone, toluene, formaldehyde, lots of highly flammable chemicals. But not in a phone repair shop. There's no reason for him to have so much liquid accelerant on site. Just another huge red flag." He paused to take a sip of his water, and perhaps to give me a chance to speak, but I just rubbed my sweaty palms on my pants and waited for him to continue. "So I visited Mr. Dingham at home to ask why he kept so much acetone in his store. And it was the shortest interview in the history of my career. Within 5 minutes, the man just cracked like an egg, crying and apologizing and fessing up. So we arrested him on charges of first-degree felony arson and felony homicide."
"Homicide?"
"That's the worst part of the story. One of the first responders was a firefighter named Deshaun Wilson. 29 years old. The floor gave way and Deshaun fell into the basement. Half the building came down on top of him." He paused to show me a photograph of the deceased hero. Deshaun posed in his firefighter's cap and uniform with a young woman and a baby boy. "That's his widow, Kim, and their son, Deshaun Jr." "Are you sure your daughter hasn't mentioned any of this?"
"She's been really busy with her new job. There hasn't been a lot of time for phone calls."
He nodded, and then made a small notation on his pad.
Well, I'm sure you're busy too, so let me cut to the chase. Mr. Dingham is getting sentenced on Friday, and I've been helping out the prosecutors. We want the judge to have all the relevant information, and the more I get to know Mr. Dingham, the less I understand his motivation. Why burn down the business? He says he did it for the money, but when I asked why he wanted the money, how he planned to use the money, he couldn't answer me. He had no idea. Isn't that strange? I lifted my glass to my lips and swallowed some water and tried to look like I was thinking. Maybe he had financial problems.
I thought the same thing, so I looked into it, Mr. Zatowski. And you know what? Turns out his grubby little business did all right. When you charge people $60 for a little piece of glass, you make a real nice profit margin. Plus, the man has zero debt, no sick relatives, not much family at all, and no real ambitions, which was the biggest surprise. Arson is a lot of hard work, a massive endeavor. And I got the sense Mr. Dingham never really worked hard at anything. He seemed happy to coast along at his store, build his crazy Lego models, and watch a staggering amount of internet pornography. All of which led me to wonder if, maybe, Mr. Dingham had a partner. He paused for another drink of water, then asked, "Did you know he was paying Margaret $22 an hour? I think he really valued her."
"Oh, I agree. I think he valued Margaret a real lot. I've read a couple hundred of their text messages, and it's clear they were very close." I didn't like what he was insinuating. The man was 46 years old. If he had feelings for my daughter, I'm sure they weren't reciprocated.
"I have some images suggesting otherwise. Found them on his phone. Boudoir photos is what I think they're called. Not the sort of pictures you'd normally share with your supervisor."
He tried swiveling his computer to show me, but I held up my hand, indicating that I did not wish to see them.
"Anyway, I visited your daughter earlier this week. I asked her about the fire, and she said she was home that weekend. Visiting you, and," he checked his notes, "you and Aunt Tammy. Does any of this sound familiar?"
"Very familiar. There was snow on Saturday, and Tammy came over with her foster kids. Maggie played with them in the backyard."
He smiled at my use of the name Maggie and scribbled something on his notepad. Then he placed a little paper calendar on the table between us. It showed all the weeks and months of the year, and he pointed to the first weekend in February. "Is this the Saturday you're describing? February 7th?
"Yes, I think so."
"It's better for me if you're sure. Can you say with absolute certainty that Maggie was here, in this house, on Saturday, February 7th?
"Yes, I am absolutely certain."
"And what time did she arrive?"
I repeated the question, word for word. "And what time did she arrive?" Leonard Summers allowed himself a small smile. I suppose in that moment, he knew he had me.
"Correct, Mr. Zatowski. You said there was snow on Saturday afternoon, and your sister Tammy came over with her foster kids, so I'm just asking you to think back a tiny bit further. What time did Maggie get to your house?"
"I don't remember."
"Well, it's really important that you do. It's the reason I drove all this way to speak with you."
He sat back in his chair and drank his water, and then let his eyes wander around my kitchen.
"Just take your time and think back."
"I'm sorry," I told him. "I'm drawing a complete blank.
I have no idea. He nodded, like this was precisely the answer he expected. I know I'm putting you in the hot seat. This is your daughter we're talking about. Your only child, am I right? So here's what I'm going to do. Before I repeat the question, as a show of good faith from one father to another, I'm going to lay all my cards on the table. I think this fire was Maggie's idea. I think she read somewhere that 80% of arsons are never solved, and she decided those odds were pretty good. So she convinced Oliver to start the fire and split the insurance money. Is that what he says? He shook his head. No, sir. Then what proof do you have? Not a whole lot, since I'm being honest. But we did find two sets of footprints in the lot behind the building. A men's size 11 and a woman's size 7, both with traces of acetone. Do you know your daughter's shoe size, Mr. Zatowski? I haven't bought her shoes in a long time. She's a size 7. So are lots of women. True, but Oliver Dingham doesn't know lots of women. He doesn't know any women. I've been through his phone. I've been through all his contacts and photos. He had a pretty solitary existence before your daughter came along. He certainly didn't have anyone sending him boudoir photos. Some part of me knew he was telling the truth, but I couldn't bring myself to admit it. I don't know anything about the photos, but she's not a criminal. Oh, I think we're all criminals to some degree. There's a whole wide spectrum of illegal and immoral behavior. He drew an arc in the air to help illustrate his metaphor. At the one end, you've got your Jeffrey Dahmers and your Ted Bundys. And on the other end, you've got millions of morally upright citizens who cheerfully drive 10 miles over the speed limit because they know they'll never get ticketed. And we're all at different places on this spectrum. Don't you agree? I bet your Maggie's somewhere right in the middle. She's never been in trouble. Well, that's hardly true. Wasn't she caught shoplifting as a kid? All kids shoplift. But she got in fights, too. That's rare for girls. I shook my head. No, she never got in fights. I guess you didn't hear about them, but there's video online if you look back far enough. Kids love sharing this stuff. They post a fight on YouTube, and 10 years later they forget all about it. But the internet never forgets. Maggie had a pretty explosive temper back in high school, wouldn't you say? She lost her mother. Those were tough years. Of course they were, Mr. Zatowski, and I'm sorry for your loss. But college was tough for Maggie, too, right? That whole sorority business, selling answers to tests. She had nothing to do with that. Right. Right. All the blame went to that other girl, the one who dropped out of school, Jessica Sweeney. You know I called her the other day to get her side of the story. She lives in Arizona now, back home with her parents, trying to put her life together. She told me your daughter was a narcissistic sociopath. I wasn't familiar with that term, so I had to go home and look it up. It's a kind of person who doesn't feel any empathy or guilt. No close friends, just lots of superficial acquaintances. People she can manipulate to get what she wants. I reminded him that Maggie was completely exonerated, so what was the point of listening to a nutcase like Jessica Sweeney? Because her story fits my pattern, Mr. Zatowski. And I see this pattern continuing, escalating, accelerating. If we don't stop it now, if we don't get Maggie the help she needs, Where does it go from here? I reminded him that she had a new job, that she had a whole bright future ahead of her.
Maybe so, Leonard Summers said. Or maybe she just keeps on making bad choices. I think there's a real risk of that happening. I once heard a doctor say that the human brain isn't fully developed until the age of 25, which means there's still time if we get her the help she needs. Or else she keeps going down this same path, and I don't know where it ends.
She's on a good path now, I told him. She'll have a bright future.
He sighed, as if he'd reached the conclusion that he was never going to convince me.
I didn't come here to argue about Maggie's future, he said, and again he tapped the paper calendar on my kitchen table. I'm just asking what time she arrived at your house on Saturday, February 7th, and I encourage you to answer the question very, very carefully.
After he drove away, I poured myself a drink to make my hand stop shaking. Then I went over to my computer and searched for information on Deshaun Wilson. YouTube had a television clip from WCVB, one of the local Boston news affiliates, titled "Watertown Firefighter and Father Dies After Battling Blaze. Tragic Loss." His wife, Kim, had rushed to the scene of the accident, and the news anchor was interviewing her in front of the smoldering wreckage. She was wrapped in a gray emergency blanket and cradling her infant son and openly weeping. She said, "This is a terrible, terrible day." And I had to turn it off. I couldn't bring myself to watch. Then I called my daughter and told her about my visitor.
"It's over, Maggie. He knows everything."
"What are you talking about?"
"The fire, Dr. Cellphone."
"Dad, I had nothing to do with that fire. I was at your house that weekend, remember?"
She spoke like there was an unknown third person sharing the line and listening to our conversation. And who knows, maybe there was.
"You need to tell the truth, Maggie."
"It is the truth."
"I'm going to help you. I'll hire another lawyer."
"I don't need a lawyer. I didn't do anything."
"Maggie, listen to me.
He asked about February 7th. He asked what time you came to my house."
"And?"
I took a deep breath, like I was getting ready to dive underwater.
"I said you got here Saturday morning, just before sunrise, about 5:30.
"You lied?"
"I didn't lie."
"I got there Friday, Dad, almost midnight."
"No, Maggie.
You were already asleep, so I came through the back door and went to bed."
"Enough, Maggie. It's time to come home."
"Fuck you."
"Maggie."
"Why would I come home? Why?"
"So I can help you."
"This isn't helping. I asked you for one thing. One thing."
"We'll make things right."
"No. Never. I don't want to see you anymore."
"Maggie. Come on.
Stay out of my life. Do you understand?"
After she hung up, I went to Tammy's condo and told her what happened, and she tried reaching out to Maggie on my behalf. All to no avail. We resigned ourselves to the fact that she would be arrested and arraigned on charges of arson and homicide. Instead, she flew with her corporate co-workers to a week-long sales conference in Cabo San Lucas and 5 nights of luxury at a Four Seasons resort. I never received any official explanation, but my understanding, based on the trial transcripts, is that Oliver Dingham refused to name Maggie as an accomplice or conspirator. He insisted that he acted alone and refused to place her at the crime scene. So all the prosecution's evidence was strictly circumstantial. And since Oliver was the sole beneficiary on the insurance claim, the state was happy to prosecute him and put the whole matter to rest. He was sentenced to 10 years in a medium security prison,
but only lasted 6 months before dying in an inmate-related dispute. And in the years that followed, I've come to see the situation from Maggie's point of view. As parents, we always say we'd do anything for our children, but would we really? CNN just ran a story about a 40-year-old mother who leaped from the deck of a cruise ship to save her daughter from drowning. All I had to do was tell a simple white lie, and instead, I'd nearly sent her to prison. As Maggie pulled the rest of her life together, as she demonstrated she was capable of making an honest and successful living with a real job at a real company, I felt worse and worse about my decision. I wished I could go back in time and give Leonard Summers a different answer. It would have been so easy to play dumb, to say I'd gone to bed early and never heard Maggie come home. And now I was facing the same choice all over again. Could I really stand by my daughter's side as she prepared to make the biggest mistake of her life? Or would I choose to walk away with the knowledge that I would never see her again? 3. After my shower, I put on some clean clothes and went downstairs to the living room. Abigail was standing on a chair in an ivory lace dress, arms stretched high above her head, while Tammy and Maggie made careful adjustments to her hem and sleeves.
"Can I put them down yet?"
she asked.
5 more seconds," Tammy said. "Almost. I'm tired." "I know, honey. Hang on." "Done," Maggie said. "You can relax."
Abigail dropped her arms and exhaled with relief as I reached the bottom of the stairs.
"You're just in time," Tammy said. "What do you think of our little flower girl? Doesn't she look wonderful?"
And I had to admit, the sight of Abigail brought me up short. I almost didn't recognize her. She wore a crown of white summer daisies that concealed the sharp contours of her buzz cut, and her dress had little sparkles that twinkled when she moved. "It's beautiful," I told her. "You look like a princess." Her face turned red.
"Aw, Mr. Frank, stop."
Maggie set down her sewing basket and rushed to my side.
"How are you feeling, Dad? Is your head okay?"
I just stared back at her. I supposed she was just going to pretend that nothing out of the ordinary happened last night. Reality was whatever she wanted it to be.
"Can I get you some coffee? There's still plenty of breakfast left in the kitchen. Croissants, fruit salad, some quiche."
"Maggie, I just want to talk for a bit. Would that be all right?"
"More than all right," Tammy said. "This is a big day for you two. A big day with big emotions."
She swept both of us across the room and out the front door.
"Go have your conversation outside while I finish here with Abby. And then she's going to help me fit into my dress. Because, let's be honest, I'm going to need a lot more time."
I followed my daughter out of the cottage and into the woods. We walked on a trail for a long time, without saying anything. It was like that burst out of the blue phone call back in May when she'd reached out with her big news. Clearly, we needed to talk, but neither one of us knew where to start.
"I'll answer your questions," she finally said. "And I promise I'll tell you the truth. But you have to promise to listen. You need to hear me out."
"Is he blackmailing you?"
"Who? Errol? No, of course not. Everything you saw last night was consensual."
This seemed impossible. Maybe consensual didn't mean what I thought it meant.
"We've been together a while now."
"How long?"
"Almost a year."
"I don't understand. How are you together with a 57-year-old married man? What does that even mean? How in the world?"
"Dad, I will explain everything, but I need you to listen. Don't judge, don't criticize, don't moralize. Just hear me out. Can you do that?"
I gritted my teeth and nodded,
and she began to tell me her story. She said that during her first year at capacity, Errol Gardner barely spoke a word to her. He was the sort of CEO who rarely acknowledged or even noticed all the young assistants working long hours on his behalf, or so she thought. Then one day she received an invitation to lunch. Errol described it as a new company initiative, an attempt to foster mentorship between senior executives and junior employees. Maggie said it was the least convincing pickup line she'd ever heard, but she was flattered that he'd taken an interest. She said there were a dozen other women he could have asked, and they would have all agreed to the lunch in a heartbeat. What followed, according to my daughter, was an increasingly intimate series of encounters, all under the guise of career development. Brainstorming sessions, dinner after work, late-night drinks at sales conferences, a week in Chicago at the auto show, trips to Munich and Singapore and Sydney on capacity's private jet.
Discretion was very important, Maggie explained. We were never together in Boston or Cambridge, only out of state and ideally out of the country. And I know these stories always sound cheap and tawdry, but I promise you, this is not a Harvey Weinstein situation. It's a real relationship built on respect. We go to museums. We read the same books. We like the same TED Talks.
I had to stop her right there. You know you're not the only one, right? Catherine says he's been cheating on her for years, dozens of women. You're just his latest flavor of the month. You're the new Dawn Taggart.
I'm getting to her, she said. You promised you would listen, remember?
We had reached the clearing with Big Ben, the tall tree with the two wooden swings. No one else was around, so my daughter took one and I took the other. And then Maggie continued her story.
After we were together a couple months, Errol invited me to visit Osprey Cove. This place is so important to him. He's had all of his best ideas here. All his biggest innovations were born on this lake. It was the first weekend in November, and he promised the foliage would be beautiful. We left Boston on a Saturday morning, and when we arrived in New Hampshire, he showed me the back roads that he liked to use, so he could bypass Hop's Ferry and not draw attention to himself.
But upon arriving at the camp, Errol realized that something was amiss. The first sign was the empty guard station. Hujo, the property manager, was absent from his post. Errol proceeded into the camp, and when he arrived at Osprey Lodge, there were two other cars parked in the driveway. A black BMW belonging to his wife and a silver Toyota Corolla that belonged to Dawn Taggart.
As soon as I saw the cars, I knew something was wrong. Errol turned white as a sheet. He drove all the way around the rotary and started making excuses, saying we'd have to visit some other time. But it was too late. Catherine heard his car and opened the front door. She was standing there with Aiden, and they both looked awful. I assumed it was because of me. I thought we'd been caught red-handed. But then I looked past them and saw a third person in the doorway, sprawled at the bottom of the staircase, with a broken neck. If we'd arrived 10 minutes earlier, we could have stopped the whole thing from happening.
Hujo was already at work inside the lodge, assessing the situation and plotting the best course of action. Maggie explained that he had experience with these kinds of situations from his work in Congo, Kinshasa. He assured the gardeners that everything would be okay, that he could make the girl and her car disappear. But Errol knew that Linda Taggart would report her daughter missing, and she would point the police to Aiden as the most likely suspect. His son needed an alibi from a third party, someone outside the family, willing to testify he wasn't anywhere near Osprey Cove. So Maggie raised her hand and volunteered.
We were back in my apartment by 4 o'clock that afternoon, and we stayed up half the night, talking. Aiden felt terrible about what happened. He thought we were all going to jail. But Hu-Ho promised the local police wouldn't look too hard, and he was right. The town has too much to lose if Osprey Cove goes dark. I bet Errol Gardner could walk into Hop's Ferry and shoot a person in broad daylight, and everyone would just look the other way.
While Maggie and Aiden were hunkered down in the basement apartment, Errol and Catherine were at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. They had several friends on the board who recalled spending the entire afternoon with them. And all the while, Hu-Ho was cleaning up the camp and relocating the body to some unknown location.
He waited until dark and then drove Dawn's Toyota to the state forest. Then he put some of her clothes on the trail just to confuse the police.
Maggie laughed.
It's very easy to conceal this sort of thing, if you've got enough resources. That's why the jails are full of poor people.
I couldn't believe the levity in her voice. She almost sounded boastful, proud of her role in the cover-up.
There was quite a bit of acting involved, but I'm getting pretty good at it.
Then she transformed her expression, widening her eyes and clutching her hands to her chest like she was Cinderella meeting her fairy godmother. And in a sing-song voice, she quoted an old conversation back to me.
Sometimes we're talking, and I feel like Aiden can read my mind, like we have a telepathic connection. Did you and Mom ever feel that way?
I stared back like I'd been slapped, and she laughed at my reaction.
Oh, Dad, come on. Have I ever talked that way about anyone?
I thought you'd fallen in love. I was happy for you.
I never said I loved him. You assumed I loved him. Because I am excited for this wedding. But the marriage is strictly business. We'll make public appearances as husband and wife, but in private, there's no commitment. Aiden can sleep with whoever he wants. Not Gwendolyn, unfortunately. And that's a shame. I think he always had a little crush on her. But he's rich and good-looking. He'll find someone new.
She seemed oblivious to the cruelty and callousness of her words. Gwendolyn was murdered, I reminded her. And now you're an accomplice to her murder. Maggie shook her head.
No more than you, or Tammy, or anyone else at the camp. I don't know what they did to her. I never saw anyone lay a hand on her.
What if Aiden changes his mind? I asked. He's looked miserable all weekend. What if he goes to the police and confesses?
Never gonna happen. He loves his mother too much. He doesn't want to see her go to jail. This is his only viable option.
And you? What are you getting out of this?
Well, I'm not Don Taggart, I'll tell you that much. $45,000 isn't going to cut it. I insisted on an ironclad prenuptial agreement. Following a period of at least 6 months and no more than 12, Aiden and I will announce our separation and file for divorce. We'll split all our combined assets 50-50, including his penthouse apartment and his 80,000 shares of capacity stock. At which point, I promise you will never have to work another day in your life. You can wave a giant middle finger at UPS and tell them all to go to hell.
I like UPS, Maggie. UPS has put food on our table for 26 years.
Fine, Dad. Whatever. Run your body into the ground if it makes you happy. I'm just saying you'll have a choice.
And in the meantime, you'll keep sleeping with Errol Gardner while you're married to his son?
I'm not asking for your approval, she reminded me. I'm asking you to respect my decisions.
From our perch on the swings, we had a partial view of Lake Wyndham, and we could see dozens of brightly colored sailboats moving across the water. All these happy families spending time together, parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles.
I found it hard to square the beauty of my surroundings with all these ugly confessions. Maggie, we have to leave.
I'm not going anywhere.
You can't go through with this. It's a perversion of marriage. The opposite of everything your mother and I believed in. We forbid this marriage. She laughed an ugly laugh, a short, harsh bark.
Oh, you forbid it? What is this, a Jane Austen novel?
Let's get out of here. Quit your job at Capacity and come home. Stay with me until you get back on your feet, and I promise I will never breathe a word to anyone. But if you don't, if you go through with this wedding and marry Aiden Gardner, I am going straight to the police, to real police, not the local Keystone cops, and I will tell them everything. Maggie glanced around, checking to make sure no one was walking nearby, and then she lowered her voice.
Dad, please don't make threats like that. I know you're not serious, but the wrong people could overhear you and jump to false conclusions.
I am serious. I can't stay here and watch you do this.
You don't have a choice. They have your Jeep. They have your keys. And Hu-Ho knows what happened last night. You're not leaving this camp without his permission. And even if you did, where would you go? You have no proof and no evidence. Errol and Catherine have donated millions of dollars to hundreds of charities, and you're just the UPS guy. No one is going to believe you.
I pointed out that Linda and Brody Taggart would help support my story.
Sure, a second-grade teacher and a drunk janitor. And meanwhile, Jerry and his team will get to work, and they will absolutely destroy you. They will take you apart brick by brick. You'll lose your job, your house, your reputation. I've seen them do it to other people, Dad. And it's brutal.
It's a risk we have to take. You can't trust these people. What if they're playing you? What if they turn around and try to pin this whole thing on you? Maggie was confident this could never happen.
We spent a long time planning this wedding, and I've got hours of conversations on tape. Me, Errol, Catherine, Aiden, even Jerry. If they ever tried something, I'd bring them all down with me.
This was a revelation. Maggie, if you've got those conversations on tape, you've got all the power in the world. You can turn them over to the FBI. You could be their star witness. She stared back at me like I was missing the point.
If I go to the FBI, I get nothing. I've invested a whole year with this family. I'm 2 hours away from lifelong financial independence, and you're suggesting that I quit?
I'm begging you to quit.
Dad, I'm going to say something, and it's going to hurt, but you need to hear it. I am never coming home to Stroudsburg. It's too small. It's too cheap, and all the people are too sad. You all have no idea what you're missing. This world we live in, it's so much bigger and more amazing than any of you realize. It's like, how can I put this? You don't even know what you don't know.
She shook her head.
I'll never go back. I'd rather put a bullet in my brain.
I heard footsteps, and we turned to see Sierra Levinson sauntering up the trail, dressed in a wide-brimmed straw hat and a slim-fitting floral dress.
Sorry to interrupt y'all's daddy-daughter time, but I wanted Margaret to know the stylists are here to do everyone's hair. They can start with other people, but we thought you might want to go first.
Thank you, Sierra,
Maggie said.
I'll be there in 5 minutes. Have her wait for me, okay?
Of course. No rush,
she said. And then she swatted a playful hand across my shoulder.
Don't look so nervous, Frank. You're going to do great today.
Maggie waited until Sierra was down the trail before speaking again.
I know you're unhappy, but if you love me as much as you say you do, you'll respect my decision. Put on your tuxedo. Walk me down the aisle, and say something sweet during the reception. That's all I'm asking. You've spent the last 3 years saying you would do anything for me. Well, this is what I need. Today, right now, are you going to support me or not?
And when she framed the question like that, I didn't have much of a choice. 4. I returned to my bedroom and found my suitcase had been moved. It looked like a housekeeper had come through and cleaned up my mess. All the vomit in the bathroom was gone, and my sailboat bunk bed had been remade with fresh linens and blankets. All my clothes were folded and put away in the dresser, and somebody must have gone around and chased away all the daddy long legs because I didn't see any more. Even the cedar closet was finally free of them. I unzipped my garment bag and carefully unpacked the components of my tuxedo. It was a beautiful suit, hand-tailored in Italy, a pearl-gray jacket with matching vest and flat front pants. The white twill shirt was immaculately pressed and cool to the touch. I carefully pushed the black onyx studs through the buttonholes. The accessory package included a clip-on bow tie, but in the weeks leading up to the wedding, I'd spent many hours in front of my bathroom mirror practicing and mastering the real deal. Now I could knot a real bow tie in 90 seconds flat. I wasn't sure if anyone at the wedding would notice the difference, but I felt better knowing it was done right. I was fastening my cufflinks into my shirt sleeves when my cell phone buzzed with an incoming call. Supercuts. Hey, Vicky.
Frank, is everything okay?
Yeah, sorry. Everything's fine.
I've been so worried about you. I thought you were going to call me last night. What happened to the girl?
They found drugs in her cottage, something called xylazine. The words stuck in my throat like glue, but I managed to force them out. She seemed like a very troubled person.
And Dawn Taggart? What about her?
It was just a big misunderstanding, Vicky. I hated myself for lying, but I sure couldn't admit the truth. I think what happened is I'm just not used to these kinds of people. Because Stroudsburg is such a small town, I've been misinterpreting a lot of things. But everything's better now. It's all straightened out. She must have heard something in my voice that she didn't like.
Are you sure? My son seemed pretty worried about you, Frank. He wouldn't go into detail, citing his journalistic code of ethics or what have you. But he seemed very uncomfortable with the whole situation.
I assured Vicky that Todd was wrong, that everything was fine, and then added that the ceremony was starting in an hour, so I need to finish getting dressed.
Okay, I'll let you go,
she said. But then instead of hanging up, she stayed on the line.
Are you sure everything's okay?
I'm fine. I'll call you when I get home.
All right. Good luck with your toast.
Right, the toast. After I ended the call, I opened my desk drawer and took out the single sheet of yellow-lined paper with my final draft. I know her mother's watching us from heaven, and I know she's pleased by what she sees. And at last, I realized why I'd struggled so much with the toast, why my speech had always felt so false and phony. I suppose deep down inside, I had never believed a word of it.